Hey Houston, Conn's prices are invincible. That means prices have been cut low, as in amazingly low, as in won't be beat. In fact, we're backing it up with our low price guarantee. Invincible prices on appliances, furniture, electronics, mattresses, and more. Not invincible enough for you? How about free next day delivery on appliances, TVs, and mattresses? And payment options for everyone, whether you have good credit or building it. Visit Conn's today and find out what invincible feels like.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Hi, I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
And our guest today, well, he's not exactly a household name.
How many billions have you made worldwide?
Except...
How's that going for you?
Except he represents a household name. The household name he represents is Marvel. And he is the head of Marvel Studios. Is that how we refer to it?
That's right.
And his name is Kevin Feige. He's also a proud graduate of the USC School of Cinematic Arts, SCA as we call it down on campus, and has been kind enough to come back to my class and others with his productions of some size, the Marvel super hits of recent years. And Kevin Feige, welcome.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you here. And one of the things I love about having you in class is when you bring these blockbuster movies, often with their writers and directors in tow, you can answer any question any student has. The nerdiest fanboy question in the room, you can answer and do. And you answer with enthusiasm, and there's not a hint of, don't bother me with that, or yeah, it's too minuscule, too obscure to talk about. You are the right man for the right job, seems to me.
It's a great joy coming to your class because I attended that class, 466.
Is it still? Yeah, 466.
466. When even before I was a film student, I attended that class. You used to be able to line up, and if there was any extra seats, you could go in. And now to be able to bring it back with you as the
were you there when the Charles teacher. Chaplin was teaching?
I was.
Yeah.
Yes.
Do you remember? Some of the guests you saw?
I do.
Stand out?
I do. I remember we saw a great movie called Sneakers and Alden Robinson, who I still never met again to this day. Don't know him. Haven't worked with him. But he was such a great guest.
Who later made Field of Dreams.
Yes. Or even before that, before Sneakers, I think he did Field of Dreams. And it was the first time I ever saw The Usual Suspects.
Mm.
And a young director named Bryan Singer walked out onto the stage. And it was so early that nobody knew who he was. So people had just seen this amazing movie. And if you know Brian, he looks about 25 years younger than he actually is.
I think he now looks about 22.
Yeah. So at the time, he looked 4.
Yeah.
And the audience gasped. And it was only about – it was a couple years later that I was working with him on X-Men 1.
That's the thing. What a trip that you got to see him in class and then work with him.
Yes.
That's amazing.
Now, how does a nice boy from Jersey wind up at USC?
Well, I got very lucky and applied to the school and got accepted during my senior year. I got early admission, which I was very excited about. So in 1991, so it's been almost, 26 years now. But I didn't get into the film school right away. So I was there for a number of years doing all the general elective courses, getting rejected every single semester from the film school until finally, just when it's almost too late, second semester junior year, I got in.
Now, what drove you there? Give us a little idea of your background and what turned you on, what fired you when you were young?
Movies. Mm-hmm. I love movies. Since I can remember, and of course the movies as I was growing up were the Star Wars movies or the Indiana Jones movies. I like the Star Trek movies. I'm one of those rare nerds that probably loves Star Wars and Star Trek equally and could defend them voraciously to anyone who's saying a negative thing about either one. And it was, of course, reading the one of those early biographies, Skywalking by Dale Pollack of George Lucas, where they talked about this place, USC.
Huh.
And it listed all these other, Robert Zemeckis, my other favorite filmmaker, and Ron Howard, and all of these filmmakers all went to this one mythical place on the other side of the country. And it's the only school I applied to.
Wow.
It's so funny you say
mythical. Were your
mythical.
Parents encouraging
very,
in this?
Very. Uh-huh. Yeah, I was not getting very good grades in school at the time when I discovered this university. I was probably junior high school, mm-hmm. not so great, and a very smart person said to me, you know how you get into colleges like that? How? They look at your grades. I said, they do? And the next semester started getting on the dean's list and getting very good grades, only with that goal in mind.
Well, talk about motivation. Yeah. My goodness.
Absolutely.
Now, were you a voracious comic book reader as well?
Well, it was much more the movies. Mm-hmm. Richard Donner's Superman, who I would later go on to work for Richard Donner and his wife, Lauren Shuler Donner, the producer, mm-hmm. which is what led me to X-Men and to Marvel. I love that movie. Tim Burton's Batman, I was first in line on the Thursday night preview for that for the opening of that movie at a mall in Secaucus, New Jersey, where my father lived. So I always loved the movies much more. So I always say I was much more likely to be at the movies on Friday than I was to be at the comic book shop on Wednesdays. Mm-hmm. But Wednesday, of course, being New Comic Book Day.
Right.
As the two, I have to just say, because the visual of it, of my husband and our engineer, Aristotle, both nodding, yes. going, yes, Wednesday is New Comic Book Day.
And the X-Men was probably the most popular comic book at that time, and I had friends that read it. So I absorbed a lot of it by osmosis and the cartoons and things like that. But really my question was, why don't they make more movies about – these things would make great movies, even other than Superman and Batman, which were the ones that existed at that time.
And indeed, they were a rarity. I mean, Superman, the Richard Donner Superman with Christopher Reeve, was, I guess, the first one in many years. What precedes that? I mean, we have to go back to the days of the serials almost.
I think so. You can get really nerdy and talk about Condor Man. Mm-hmm. The Walt Disney classic Condor Man starring Michael Crawford. But maybe that was after.
Michael
maybe
Crawford?
That was early 80s. That might have been – he was Condor Man before he was the Phantom.
Before he was the Phantom.
There weren't many. Yeah. There weren't many. And that movie still to this day, I think Richard Donner's Superman, the movie is the archetype that that we strive for. Mm-hmm. It's amazing.
So I'm really old school because I was raised on serials by this guy.
Yes.
And in the VHS era.
Yes.
Great.
And we were walking down Hollywood Boulevard. We were leaving the press room at the Oscars with all these things around us, right? And coming down Hollywood Boulevard to go to our car, and my dad says, there he is, and it's Buster Crabbe.
Nice.
And I love Buster Crabbe. Nice. As much as I love Buster Crabbe, that's
the star, of course, of Flash Gordon.
Yes. Yes.
And now, Buck Rogers.
But my love for him does not touch my dad's love for Ming the Merciless.
Yes.
I swear, you could just fill our house with Ming things.
Wow.
And he would be very happy camper.
I love those old serials, and you look back, and of course they're dated, and of course, but they were so, and I love, and I'm very lucky, and I said this once I think I went back to USC, and I said, like, how lucky, if I were in this business at any other time, I would have been very happy making serials and lighting the bottle rockets that made the rocket ship go up the track through the smoke clouds. The fact that I get to work in this business in a time where these movies, at least, right now, until we screwed up, are very, very popular.
Yeah.
And not just the serials playing in the morning for the kids.
You're in a universe. It's called universe.
I mean, but this is a sea change that I think a lot of people, especially younger people, don't really understand, nor should they. It's not their time period. But in the 40s, these things existed only as Saturday matinee entertainment
for kids in theaters.
There used to be Saturday matinees. And the serials, which were chapter, cliffhangers week after week, were the one place you could get to see these comic book heroes in rather cheaply made, if endearing, versions of the comics. But that was considered kid stuff, strictly kid stuff. In the 50s, there was a flurry of post-World War II, post-atomic bomb science fiction movies. Not strictly for kids, but a lot of them were. But then you did have smart ones like The Day the Earth Stood Still and Them and some other science fiction. And, of course, the Invasion of the Body Snatchers, Forbidden Planet. So there was some intelligent sci-fi as well. But that's about as far as it went in terms of the universe of fantasy.
Yes.
Ray Harryhausen created his own genre practically with his films, Seventh Voyage of Sinbad and so forth, Jason and the Argonauts and such. But these were, again, kind of marginalized in terms of mainstream Hollywood. It's like, that's fine. Go and do your little film. You make a little profit. That's fine. And Walt Disney was in a class by himself,
yes.
doing his own thing.
Yes.
Very successfully. But even he was not considered part of the Hollywood mainstream. He was Walt Disney, his own world, yep. his own studio, his own world. And then came Superman with Christopher Reeve in the title role. And even then, that, it was not a rush to copy that.
Right.
It was not like an onslaught after that. It took time. And so the kids of the last 20 years who've grown up on a steady diet of these spectacular films, ever more spectacular films, which are pitched to a wide and general audience and not at kids or not just at kids,
right.
Are going through a kind of a fever dream of what could be that didn't used to be. Just as there were no special effects movies before Star Wars.
That's right.
I mean, 2001 is the only thing that serves as a kind of a forerunner or a precedent for what George Lucas had to put together or cobble together in order to make his movie.
And it really was Star Wars, I think, that changed that in a lot of ways. And some people bemoan that, and I look at that as a great thing. Certainly the biggest influence on my life and what led me to other aspects of cinema was Star Wars. And even, frankly, it was Return of the Jedi, because I was 10 years old when Return of the Jedi came out. I think I didn't see Star Wars until its re-release in maybe 80 or 81.
Mm-hmm.
I was born in 73, so I was too young when it first came out.
Mm-hmm.
I had never felt anything like that before.
Mm.
And chasing that feeling is what we do. It's what, I just came over from the cutting room. And as we're working on a cut, and we heard some initial score today, and it's always the bar is a feeling that I had, whether it's Star Wars or any great movie, this what we, at best, that we want to evoke this from, in the audience in this, whatever the particular moment is that we're
working on.
What are
you working on in the cutting room right now?
But right now, it's Spider-Man Homecoming.
Which is coming out when?
July.
We'll get to that later.
Yeah.
But I don't want to lose track here of your saga.
Looking at IMDb, and IMDb is not always right, but looking at IMDb, you had like 16 different things in pre-production / production.
Right.
And I was looking at that going, I can't imagine what it is to go
it's
in
It's not
and
quite
say,
that many, but so it's a lot of fun stuff.
Who are we killing today? Who are we making fly this morning? You're wearing this hat. You just came in, you're wearing this hat, and I asked you what that's for the next Thor movie. It's like I can't begin to imagine keeping straight all of your characters. And
It's a great time to do this. And people ask me that a lot, keeping them straight. Well, it's the same way I kept all of my Star Wars action figures straight and all of their names and all of their backstories. Both from the films, from the additional expanded universe material, and from what I would make up myself in my Sarlacc pit in the backyard, sandbox.
At least you're not alone anymore.
Exactly.
That's how I feel for all of my friends who are like you, who are like my dad. Is it's like, well, you guys are kind of ruling the world right now. That's all right.
And you have a bigger sandbox.
Yes. Yeah.
Considerably bigger sand.
Yeah. It's the action figures are these esteemed actors who will bring and breathe life and soul into these characters beyond anything that we could envision.
So how did it all begin for you? So you graduate from USC. Now what?
It was before I graduated from USC. I was going to USC. As I said, I finally got in the second semester of my junior year, the week of the Northridge earthquake. Ooh. So my first film classes had after the occasional aftershocks mm-hmm. in class. And a few months after that, I realized that all the very smart people were getting these internships where you didn't get paid any money, but you could go and work for free, which sounded like a great privilege to me at the time, on movies or in a production office. And I went to the old George Lucas building at the film school. And on the second floor there, they had posting for internships. And there were lots, and maybe a lot of them could be good, but I always felt, if I'm going to do this, if I'm going to work for free, wouldn't it be great to do it for somebody you admire or for somebody who has done great things. Yeah. And that was the listing for Donner Schuler Donner Productions. And I sort of couldn't believe it that there was an availability there. And at the time, I knew Dick, of course, from Superman and Lethal Weapon and Goonies and The Omen. And then I soon got to know his wife, who at the time was doing the Free Willy franchise.
Oh my.
That was doing very well. Soon after I started, we did a movie called Volcano, went to New York and did a movie called You've Got Mail with Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan working for Lauren and Nora Ephron. And I got to teach Meg Ryan how to use this new thing called AOL email. went to her house, and I barely knew how to use it at the time myself. But you hit send, and then you open it.
So was that like, you know, on your resume, you had that little like special skills at the bottom?
I never put that, but people occasionally come and go, did I hear that you taught Meg Ryan email? I go, as a matter of fact, I did. And during that time, Lauren had a script that was that she had been developing, that not a whole lot was going on, and they were just starting to work on it again, and it was X-Men. And I was really interested in that, in making that kind of movie, and I just started doing notes. I just started writing notes on the new screenplays that were coming in. Lauren is gracious enough that she would read the notes and go, oh, hey, this is pretty smart. Why don't you sit in on the meetings? And the new director had been hired, and that was Bryan Singer. And that started, I think, a 3 or 4 year journey between sort of when that first happened and when the film came out in 2000.
Now, just to rewind just a little bit, for people who are thinking of or who are seriously thinking about getting into the movie industry in some way, shape, or form, would you say that take any job you can take, whether it's sweeping the floor or getting coffee, just to get your foot in the door?
Oh, absolutely, because that's exactly what I did. I was getting lunches, I was washing cars, I was walking dogs. But number one, I got to do it on the Warner Brothers lot.
Right.
So I took a super shuttle because cabs were not reliable at the time. There was no Uber. I would so it was costing me about $45 a day.
Oh, God.
This internship. Or maybe that was each way. Sometimes my friends would drive me, but sometimes I'd have to take a super shuttle from USC to the Warner Brothers lot. But you just pull through those gates and under that water tower, and you're working on a movie lot.
Yeah.
And at the time, ER was filming, so there was always – it was just like a movie. The friends were sitting in this part of the commissary. Mm-hmm. Doctors with fake blood-stained scrubs were waiting for their turkey sandwiches.
And walking on that back lot there, I mean, you're in Hollywood.
This the Western lot Hollywood. Was still there at the time.
Mm-hmm. It's also one of the most beautiful.
It is beautiful.
It's a beautiful lot.
It is great. So I really believed early on, and I think my parents instilled this in me a little bit, which was basically, well, if you can't get a coffee order right, nobody's going to ask you to do anything else.
Exactly.
So did I want to make coffee for a living? No. Did I want to deliver lunch for a living? No. But I had a feeling that if I did that well, maybe there would be something else. And I don't know that always happens, but you work for somebody like Lauren and Dick, who are very gracious and who I could see that their assistants and their executives all moved up internally through the ranks. And you need a mentor like that as well. Mm-hmm. I was very lucky.
So Lauren said, "I like your notes. You can sit in on the development meetings," and you made your voice known and heard.
Yeah, and I was again very lucky that Bryan was open to that input. His producer Tom DeSanto, David Hayter, who was the screenwriter later on the project, and ended up going to Toronto. Speaking of making movies in places other than Los Angeles, mm-hmm. I was in Toronto, gosh, for about 8 or 9 months. As we did that film, started filming before we had a lead actor, which is a story I always appreciate, because every film is hard, every film is difficult, every film seems like it's the first film that's ever been made, and how could this enterprise possibly succeed or possibly work? It's the most foolish endeavor. But when you have worked on films like even X-Men 1, which took a long time to develop, which there were a lot of different writers on, went up and down over the years, much less the movie I did after that, which was the first Spider-Man, which had been up and down for decades.
Yeah.
But Logan, the new Wolverine movie, which I've not seen yet, but looks awesome to me, and I'm very excited to see. And I can't, and everyone's saying it's Hugh's last one. He sent me a very nice note recently, and I've not worked on a movie with him in 5 movies because later in my story, we become Marvel Studios, which is separate from the X-Men films. But I was involved in those first 3. And starting a movie before we had the lead actor, because the actor had fallen out. So whenever we have something on a movie, I go, at least we have a lead actor.
Right.
At least, like, it's not that bad. It's still, and that still worked out.
Now, is there a way of summarizing, and there may not be, So a way of summarizing why some of these projects take so long to come together in terms of a story, in terms of nailing a script and knowing that you have the story that you want to tell. You say, you know, Spider-Man and X-Men are examples of long gestation periods.
I think there are any number of reasons. I think ultimately it comes down to, is there enough support for a project? Are people willing to bet their jobs, which is what people in executive positions at studios are essentially doing with almost every movie that they greenlight? And as you were pointing out, there was Superman, there was Batman, both DC franchises. There have been almost no Marvel franchises at all. Some direct-to-video stuff, famously Roger Corman version of Fantastic Four that never was released. So it's sort of a big bet to say, let's take this comic book franchise X-Men and turn it into a feature. And it was not certainly comparative to the films we make now, and even compared to the big films of that time, X-Men 1 was a very low budget for that kind of a movie, very low budget, which was great. Because it meant you had to focus on the character and you had to focus on the dynamics between those characters because you didn't have all the money in the world to do anything else. And I remember being, you know, just sort of thinking, wouldn't it be cool if Magneto, in the comic books, there was this great panel at the time where Magneto would use his magnetic powers to take a gun and split it into all its component parts. So it was an amazing drawing, and I had it up by my desk, and I went, wouldn't it be cool to do that? No, we couldn't do that. We had wires that lifted up a shotgun and turned it around. It's like, one day, we'll be able to do amazing things.
What have been like the – so we've all got like, you know, there's 12-year-old me. There's 5-year-old me that goes, ah. So whether it's seeing a band that you've loved since you were a kid and you're older, or in this case, reading about a comic book character and seeing it, what's been the most like, oh, my God, it's real life and it's happening and I'm here?
My entire life for the past 26 years since coming to L.A. has been nothing but that, frankly. I mean, it took me years before I even realized I was actually out here going to school and working and not being on vacation. Growing up in New Jersey, I had come to L.A. maybe once or twice. Gone to Disneyland, gone to Universal Studios.
Yeah.
So I was out here for almost 10 years before it felt like I wasn't still on a family trip or on vacation. I remember PAing on a student film at USC, and that's kind of a grind. Like, that's about as low on the totem pole as it's below, it's in the dirt under the totem pole.
Copying credit.
As being
maybe
a PA on a student film. But again, there was a listing in the loading dock at USC, and I called the number, and they said, all right, be at the loading dock at 5 a.m. on Saturday morning. I was like, you got it. And next thing I know, I was in the back of some student's car who I thought was a celebrity because they were a USC student, and I was just a freshman that had just gotten there, going down the 110 to the Mojave Desert or wherever the heck we were filming. And I have a distinct memory of looking out the back seat, being, you know, having been in L.A. for now 2 weeks. I'm like, I'm in a car going to a movie set. I've made it. I can't believe it. So I do think, and it is, making movies is very hard, and you put all of your passion into it, and there can be all, it's fraught with anxiety. So if you don't find the pleasure in every little thing, or don't realize how bad is it, you're getting to make these movies.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool. Don't do it. Because otherwise, and sure enough, going back to the PAing on student films, I remember that, you know, we'd finish a 12, 14, 15-hour day with, you know, red vines and pretzels at the student craft service.
Right.
And you'd come back, and they'd drop you off to school, and they'd say, okay, see you tomorrow at 5. And I'd go down. I went down the next morning, and there were three PAs. I was the only one there. The other two were like, forget this. I remember distinct. And then I became a film student. I had PAs on my film. And we were shooting, you know, for 3 weekends in a row. And after the second day, a young freshman who just arrived goes, how long is this movie going to be again? After he'd been there for about 10 hours. I said, probably about 2.5 minutes. It's a short little 2.5 minute film. And he went, bye. That's okay. You weed them out.
But what costumes, what props? Because, you know, so Bryan Singer is friendly with a lot of my friends. I've gotten to go to his house before. And when he's in the mood, he will get out one of the Superman capes.
Wow.
And the Wolverine claws. And I one time pranced around the house wearing the cape and the claws.
Together.
Just, yeah, oh yeah.
That's quite a mashup.
I was super Wolverman, yes. I had a good time.
It happens on most movies. The first time was on that first X-Men film where we've been filming for, I don't remember exactly, but 4 or 5 weeks. And we were on a night shoot filming some connective tissue. And it was the first night all the characters were going to be together.
Oh, wow.
In the costume. Yeah. And I think I was on the phone in Lauren's trailer or Brian's trailer, and I got off the phone in one of the back rooms of the trailer and walked into the main room of the trailer, and all of the X-Men were standing there in costume getting final approval from Brian before they went on set, and I had an out-of-body experience.
Wow.
I sort of couldn't believe it. And it's happened on almost every movie we've done since when the actors are in those outfits – together, much less when they're like certainly the Avengers and characters that have been in other movies now standing next to each other. Just happened a couple of weeks ago in Atlanta on the next Avengers film, Infinity War. And I never fail to get a thrill out of that. It's pretty sound.
Well, do you take the hammer? Do you take the cape? Like, what do you go for?
We have three Iron Man suits in our office on display in the lobby.
How many times?
Relatively
have you
worn recently.
Suits?
I don't fit in those suits. I don't fit in those suits.
Have you put the helmet on?
I'd be afraid to get stuck, and somebody would film it and it would go viral.
You'd have to get out
Vaseline,
like
like a cat with the bucket on the head.
All right. So the X-Men film gets made, and at what point, if any, did you, in your role, still a sort of a not a major role, but a player involved. At what point did you and Brian and or the studio, Fox, have confidence that you'd done it, that it was going to work?
I think it was after the opening weekend, as is often the case.
Yeah.
You know, the fate of a movie is written in the first weekend, not always, but much of the time. And I don't remember exactly what it opened to now, but it fulfilled their expectations. And I don't remember exactly. Certainly it was Fox that made the decision to move on to the sequel. And I think it was later that summer that they made the calls to everyone saying, let's go do this again. And by that point, I had gone from working for Lawrence Wheeler Donner and being an associate producer due to her graciousness and Fox's graciousness on X-Men to working for Marvel.
Right.
Because during that X-Men period, I got to know the then head of Marvel Studios, Avi Arad, who said, hey, you want to try to do for all these upcoming movies what you did for X-Men? Mm-hmm. And I said, yes, please.
What do you define as success? Now, in the case of that first film, Fox wanted to see numbers opening weekend, and that's how they defined its success. For the fans, it's another story. For the filmmakers, maybe another story beyond that. At this stage now, what means success to you besides the money? Obviously, it's got to work financially or there's no business, and you're in business. But what is your definition of success?
Well, I think ultimate success is the test of time, right? We're talking about Star Wars. That movie is 40 years old and is as relevant as it's ever been, right? I think that is the ultimate success. We look at Casablanca, your favorite film. You look at the first film that I was shown in Cinema 101 at SC, Citizen Kane. It's still a relevant film. So to me, it really is the test of time. So Iron Man is approaching its 10th year. So it's still, we don't know. It's still very early.
Yeah.
What always would drive us, and certainly with Iron Man 1, which is a story unto itself, and certainly represented a whole new transition for me and for my time at Marvel Studios, the ability to tell a story that the audience responds to enough that they want to see another story with those same characters. Mm-hmm. That's what comic books are. That's what the serials were. And to me, the success is, and certainly the money means the studio will agree to that. But it's not just the money, because at the time, there were films that made more money than X-Men in that summer that did not, at least not for many years, get sequels or other movies. So it's not just that. It's the audience appetite to see the continuing adventures of. And the only way they'll want to see the continuing adventures of is if they enjoyed that last adventure. So to me, in the short term, that's the barrier for success, is can we take a character that a lot of people that are shopping at Meltdown are aware of, yeah. but most people that are going to the movies on the weekend have never heard of, yeah. like Iron Man at the time, like the Guardians of the Galaxy, like Ant-Man, like most recently Doctor Strange. And to me, that's the best sign of success, is when we take something that when I first am pitching it to people, they go, what is it? The guy shrinks? It's a raccoon and a tree in space? He's a magician? Is he like Harry Potter? He's got a cloak? And then they see the movie and they go, I didn't know what to expect, but I really enjoyed that. Yeah. When are you making another one? To me, that is the highest compliment. Or the other compliment is, which is a you know, backhanded compliment, I don't usually like these movies.
But
I really liked.
Yeah. It's a tricky thing.
But you said that on our last 15 movies.
That's so funny.
So maybe you do like these movies.
You know, my mom is a perfect gauge of that, because this is, as you said, it's not her thing. And yet, she'll go see these movies and have a really good time. For me, I like them. But I don't know their backstories. I do now, because I want to stay married. I've had to learn everything. And my husband has all these comic books.
Right.
And I have to now be able to identify things on site. I'm still not that good at it yet, but we've only been married for a little over a year, so I think I have some time, because he judges me. But, you know, it's something that I think is incredible about the movies that you guys make, is that I can enjoy it knowing nothing. And he enjoys it in an entirely different way, because he knows everything. And then I get to ask a million questions, and he doesn't kill me, because he actually likes answering. Except when he doesn't have an answer, and then I just get angry.
The movies need to work for both. They need to work for people that have read them their whole lives.
Yeah.
And they need to work for people who only heard about them when they saw the coming attraction.
Mm-hmm.
And I think any good movie should do the same.
Yeah.
And I always use Harry Potter as an example of that. I'm sure I've said this in your class before. I've never read any of the Harry Potter books. I have an 8-year-old daughter who's just starting to read them now. But I had never read any of the books. I saw all of the movies once when they came out on opening weekend.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed them all.
Yeah.
And I understood them all. Had I read the books, had I watched the movies multiple times, I'm sure there's all sorts of things going on. Oh, did you hear that? That person, or that picture that just talked, that is actually this.
Yeah.
All that is cool. But it has to work, even if you don't know those other things. So people talk about Easter eggs in our films, and yes, there are a lot of them, but they're always there either to serve the story at hand or just for fun. But they can never distract from somebody going, well, I don't know what's going on anymore.
Yeah.
We don't want people to need a glossary, which I remember going to see Dune, and they passed out glossary when I was a kid, which I actually thought was really cool. But
P.S., it didn't help.
Yeah, exactly. You don't want that. We want it to work. You have bought a ticket for a self-contained experience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so whether it's the first part in a new character series, or the as Guardians of the Galaxy is a second part. Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 is both the second film in the Guardians series of films, and the 15th film in the connected Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Well, that brings us to this, I think, rather unprecedented situation that you have built up here, where there is such a thing as the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
And you have a calendar.
A calendar.
You have a calendar that tells me.
A scheme, a plot, a plan.
In
perhaps
6 years,
a plan for world domination,
see this movie.
For all we know.
Oh.
It's just incalculable to someone as simple-minded as myself that you have this master plan. How detailed is that master plan?
It started while we were doing Iron Man 1, and the idea that at the time we were competing with the other studios that had the rights to our films,
mm-hmm.
and we really believed that we had learned a lot from working with all the studios on the other Marvel films up until we got the financing to do it ourselves. And we were really thinking, what would set us apart? Number one, just our own taste, our own instincts,
mm-hmm.
The belief that it is the characters not a marquee name that is most important. The character is the marquee name. Now, of course, 10 years later, all the actors who've played the characters have become very big stars, deservedly so. But we really believed that Iron Man should be the showcase name, and that allowed us to cast a great actor who hadn't necessarily carried a blockbuster film before, in Robert Downey Jr. Also, during the production of that movie, it occurred to us that while we didn't have the rights to certain to a handful of characters that were at other studios, we had the rights to the other 8,000. And wouldn't it be fun to want to?
You have what they call in the sports world the deep bench.
It's a very deep bench, and the official number changes, but I'm pretty sure it's around, you know, it's between 5,000 and 8,000. Could they all become movies? Probably not. But could a lot of them? Yes, and they already have. So that's why Sam Jackson shows up at the end credits of the first Iron Man film to tell Tony Stark, you're part of a bigger universe, you just don't know it yet. And that was our way of letting the audience know we could do cool things. There are other characters here that could infiltrate this universe.
Okay, just a little asterisk point here, which is when you made that announcement of casting Robert Downey Jr., that sent out a message in itself. Because I remember the day I heard that news or read that news, I said, that's really cool. Robert Downey Jr. as a superhero?
Yeah.
Because he had just given a fantastic performance in...
Which one was it, Zodiac?
In Zodiac, yes in David Fincher's film Zodiac. I'm really, he's always been a great actor, but that was a really strong performance. Yeah. And I think everybody I talked to that day in the next few days had the same feeling, which was, we don't know if this is going to work or not, but it's a really interesting idea, putting an actor of his skill into that niche. And that was the first of many daring and mostly successful decisions that you've made in terms of casting your actors, casting your directors, choosing your directors and writers too. And I don't have to butter you up, Kevin, but you've done this very well, and you know it. And the fans have cheered you on mostly, except for the ones who are cranky. and that's what's really, I think, set you apart.
Mm.
Hiring Kenneth Branagh to direct a film, giving the Russo brothers the opportunity to come in and do what they did for you. You know, it's you have a great bat and ball, and you're having fun, you know, playing with it.
It's for sure. And a lot of that is lessons, you know, that I learned watching. Bryan Singer hadn't done big blockbuster special effects films before Fox and Lauren hired him on X-Men. Sam Raimi had done lots of incredibly imaginative and clever work and dramatic work. A Simple Plan was a great film, but had never done anything on that scale before Sony and Amy Pascal hired him to do Spider-Man. So I was there and I watched those decisions make sense. So it was never daunting for us to say let's hire somebody who has a great voice and who has a unique perspective. Certainly as Jon Favreau did on our first independent film.
Mm-hmm.
And people forget, Iron Man was an independent movie. We had a bond, completion bond company involved. It was an independent movie.
Wow, because Paramount released it. But
Paramount was just, a marketing and distribution agreement. Yeah.
Wow, yeah. Interesting. Even I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
Wow. So it was your neck.
It
your
was
your corporate neck.
It was the corporate neck and the character rights to some of the film rights to the characters that were on the line for Marvel.
Wow. Now, talk about building up to the Avengers, because that too was a huge hurdle, bringing multiple characters together, and you hired just the right guy. Joss Whedon was the guy to do it because he's a great writer. He's a good director too and a brilliant producer. But to me, the screenplay for that film, again, casting, everything else matters, but it's the writing in that film that knocked me out.
We were frightened of the spectacle overtaking the characters. And the reason we were most excited to make The Avengers was to see these – what right does Tony Stark – and a super soldier from the 1940s and a Norse god from outer space have to be in the same room? Zero. Zero. Doesn't make any sense. So it was fun to try to have it make sense, and then to find somebody who would relish the fun of those characters all in a room together. And that's what Joss does best. Mm-hmm.
Fun is the key word. That is what you're doing. And I know, again, from all my friends who do read these and want them to be completely true, I understand that part of it for them. But just in terms of going and seeing a movie, I now so look forward to everything that you guys bring out because I know I'm going to have a good time.
That's great.
And they're even, you know, they play on the big screen. At the same time, though, if we're trying to find something, we're trying to relax at night, you put it on because it's going to make you smile and it's going to make you laugh and then you can relax. So it's like as much as I like watching them more and more now to see those little bits and bobs now that I have some kind of context.
Yes.
It's just fun. They're fun. And the students are so lucky to have you. In my dad's class, I'm so thrilled that you always come down because you show them, first of all, that you can be a kind and decent human being and hold the position that you have, but you can also love what you do. And that's so important.
Very lucky.
Yeah, you ought to love what you do.
Yeah, it's too much fun. It's too much fun. And I know you're a big Disney fan. And then, you know, the other aspect of the story is when Disney buys Marvel, which was great and great for everything that comes with that company right now. But also, I was a colossal Disney fan. You asked me if I read comic books. I was much more obsessed with the Disney theme parks when I was a kid than I even was in comic books. Movies, again, trumped everything. But that we then end up there and on that lot where so many amazing things happen. We've never shot a full movie on that lot, but we've done pickups and we've done some additional photography. Okay. We did some additional photography for the first Guardians on the 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea stage. And that being surrounded by that sort of history is really exciting.
You get to stroll by the corner of Mickey Avenue and Dopey Drive.
Almost every day.
Yeah.
The fact that I'm not named Dopey Drive is just fortunate on my end because I'm shocked they held themselves back.
But it's great that you appreciate that. I mean, I think people need to know that, too, about you. Again, because one tends to think of, and you know the term as well as anybody does, the suits.
Mm.
People always talk about the suits, and that's a cliche that, like all cliches, has some kernel of truth in it. There are people who are suits and who are not the people we want to have dinner with necessarily. And they may do their jobs extremely well. But that's what they do. But you managed to wear both hats simultaneously.
Well, and I'm very lucky that we're surrounded by people both at Marvel Studios and now at the Disney Company that really handle the business aspect to it. Mm-hmm. I've never taken a business course in my life. Mm-hmm. I ended up with a president title. But it's really about producing movies. It's really about the creative involved that goes into these movies. And you have to be responsible. It's not just about creative. If you just think that if you ignore the business aspects, you can have the best ideas in the world and the most talent in the world. You could write a film history book about very talented, smart, idea-filled people that fell flat on their face because they were begrudging of or trying to ignore the business realities.
Yeah.
And we make movies in the real world. We make movies that take place in other worlds. But I learned early on that you have to be conscious of the real world. Otherwise, these big ideas that you have will never come to fruition. That's how you see an idea through. Having the idea is not good enough.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm lucky that the organization is structured in a way that I can really just spend 98% of the time on the creative.
Have you gotten to put your or dip your toe into the theme park aspect of this?
There
yet?
Is a little bit. There is a Guardians of the Galaxy ride opening soon at Disney's California Adventure, which we were somewhat involved in. So there's been some of that. I've gotten to know some Imagineers, been over to Imagineering a number of times.
Aren't they incredible?
It's amazing. It's the greatest place in the world.
Yes.
And that's been another one of those, is this really happening to me, sort of moments in my career.
That's great. I want to tee you up to tell a story that you shared with us when you visited class about the little postscript piece. What do you refer to those little tags as?
Tags. Yeah, we just call them tags.
All right.
Yeah.
The shawarma tag.
Oh, yes. God, I love that.
How that came about.
I love that one.
Well, we were sitting in the cutting room very, very late in the process on Avengers 1. I don't remember exactly. We were probably 2 months from release, which really means 3 weeks or so from finishing and 5 or 6 weeks from the premiere. And I don't remember exactly how it came about. There was a moment that Joss had written and Robert performed where the Avengers have won, the aliens have been defeated, the Loki is taken down, and out of nowhere, a wounded Iron Man helmet comes off and he goes, "Have you ever tried shawarma? I don't know what it is, but I always wanted to try it." And then they end up going and capturing Loki upstairs. And we used to talk about, as I was saying earlier, the fun of the characters. We used to talk about the Avengers just riding a bus together, or the Avengers all sitting around at a dinner table together. Mm-hmm. And they're around a table on a helicarrier briefly in the movie, but we've never quite done something about these spectacular, extraordinary people doing the most mundane thing
possible. The
more possible.
Menial, the funnier it is. Yeah.
And we had never quite done that. And I think Joss or somebody said, we should have had the meeting shawarma at the end, just all exhausted eating shawarma at the end. And I said, "That's the greatest idea I've ever heard in my entire life." I said, "Of course we have to do that." And the thought was, well, you can't get all of them together now. And it's like too late. We had the idea too late. And we went, "Yeah, I guess so." And then executive producer Jeremy Latcham and I went to my then assistant, Jonathan Schwartz, and said, or maybe he was associate producer on Avengers, Jonathan Schwartz, and said, "The premiere's going to be at the El Capitan. Get a map and find every shawarma restaurant in a 2-block radius of the El Capitan." He went, "Okay." Goes into his car. He takes all these pictures, comes back. I said, "Joss, take a look. Choose which location do you want?" And he looks and he goes, "For the shawarma scene?" We said, "Yeah." He goes, "You guys are crazy. Can we actually do that?" We said, "Well, we're doing the premiere. Then we're doing the junket. It's the only time all the actors would be together again. We could go get a van, take them from the junket, get in costume, go to this shawarma restaurant. It's only one shot. Shoot it and have it." And I called Robert first, I think, and said, "Robert, we have this idea to go from the junket to shoot it, and you're just there eating shawarma." And he goes, "Well, that's so crazy. We have to do it. Of course we have to do it." So cut to a few weeks later, and all the Avengers are sitting around this shawarma restaurant eating it. Chris Evans has a giant beard, as he often grows for other films in between movies. He had a big beard. So we put this prosthetic face on him that looked horrific, which is why if you watch the scene again, he's eating like he's covering his face. His whole face is covered with his own hand because he's exhausted because they're all tired. We shot it. The actors went back. They were all so gracious and so junkets are exhausting, as I'm sure you know better than anyone. And then a handful of us and our editor Jeff Ford sat on the back of the camera truck choosing the exact, you know, I don't know how long it is, 7 seconds, 10 seconds that we wanted to use because it had to go right to the mix stage and right into the prints. Oh, so there's a picture, a snapshot of us somewhere choosing that section and the back of this camera truck under a colossal billboard for the Avengers. And it only made the domestic prints. I don't think it didn't make the international prints because those have to go early. Mm-hmm. And they're not prints anymore. But we did get it on the domestic run. And that's another one of those slightly dangerous but true lessons, which is and a big belief system for us at Marvel Studios, which is you can't let a good idea – if there's a good idea, you have to figure out a way, whether it's a money issue or a time issue or a scheduling issue, make it happen. And we've driven many a line producer and many a accountant crazy with our belief that that there's got to be a way to do it.
Because it's a good idea.
It's the only thing that matters. Mm-hmm. Well, as I said, having the idea and executing the idea.
Yeah.
And that was great fun because I think it's the perfect finale for that movie and the perfect capper for the events, but also because it started, you know, with six of us in a cutting room going, "Wouldn't that be cool?" Which is how all great ideas start. "Wouldn't that be cool if we could do that?" Well, there's no way we could do that. Maybe there's a way we could do that. Yeah. And oftentimes people just don't ask. People just think, "Oh, that would be too hard. Next." But that taught us always, and you can't always do things, but when they work out like that, you have something to point to.
And something to be proud of, absolutely.
Yes. Have you pulled any Stan Lees? Have you been in any of the movies?
No, Stan Lee is much more charismatic than I am and much more endeared. I did a cameo on X-Men 1, which ended up on the cutting room floor. But the only reason I did it is because I was completely covered. I was a Weapon X tech pulling Wolverine's claws out of the oven. But I had a hood and mask, and I was completely gloves. Every inch of me was covered. I said, "Oh, that I'll do." And I could barely do that, by the way.
Have you heard Stan Lee say why he thinks it's so smart you put him in the movies? Have you ever heard his explanation for this?
I've heard many explanations.
Fair enough, sir. Fair enough. No, what he said is he thinks it's a brilliant idea because if someone misses his cameo, they now have to go back and see the movie again.
Absolutely.
Because otherwise they've missed the Stan Lee cameo. He's like, so it's a brilliant idea. You're always going to make more money.
I saw him tweeting during Oscar weekend about why they don't have the best cameo award, which is a great question.
Oh,
what a great idea.
And I remember being there for the very first one. Of let's call it the modern era. I think actually he was in some of the Incredible Hulk TV movies and things before this. But the hot dog vendor in X-Men 1,
yes. Mm-hmm.
Which was additional photography out in Malibu somewhere. And most recently, and I think I told this story in class last time, he flew to Atlanta and shot 4 cameos in one day for upcoming projects. One of which I think is maybe the best one we've ever done.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
And there have been some really good ones.
Yep. It's a high bar. It's a high bar now for Stan.
God bless him. That's great.
I love it.
And God bless you. Thank you so much for coming
by. Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
This is such fun.
Thank you both.
Now, you got to ask him your gem question. What's a movie that you like to recommend to people?
Oh, okay.
We've talked about your whole Marvel world, but we always
like to ask people. Let's go outside the Marvel world just for a moment here. I don't know how much time you have to watch movies. You have an 8-year-old, so you're obviously watching certain films.
Well, we're getting to that age where we start reliving.
Yeah.
You start bringing out films to show them.
Exactly.
Which is a great joy.
Some examples?
Well, of course, it's been the Star Wars movies. It's been the Back to the Future trilogy.
Oh, great.
Which was quite, again, another movie I should have mentioned earlier, Back to the Future. All of the films, first two in particular, incredibly influential on me as a kid. And she loved that movie. My 8-year-old daughter loved the movie. And it only occurred to me at the end of the film that she didn't quite realize that the 1980s and the 1950s were different. They were both period pieces to her. They were both drastic period pieces to her, which made me feel very old. So those are the ones. Raiders of the Lost Ark. I said we should have to. I was 8 years old when I first saw Raiders, and I remember the first. 2 times seeing the film, covering my eyes for the melty faces.
No,
you
have to know your own child and what they can tolerate and what.
But
they
that's coming up soon. Mm-hmm. So that's been a great. And E.T. is going to be coming up soon. It's going to be coming up soon.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And then getting into some of the classics and getting them past the. This doesn't. Why isn't there any color?
Yeah.
Why isn't there any? And real. And I learned early on watching films that didn't matter. That would go away. If the movie was engaging,
that would go away very quickly.
If it grabs you, it grabs you. And if not, it's not going to happen again, no matter what you do.
Yeah.
Oh, that's what a wonderful experience. I remember, that was part of the joy of with Jesse, seeing films through her eyes, and then revisiting films through her eyes and with her. One of the great joys of parenthood for a movie buff.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you sort of have to wait a while. They have to get to a certain age, and we're just there, which is fun.
Yep. Also, revisiting, as I had a chance to see Back to the Future on a big screen about a year ago. I introduced it downtown at the United Artists Theater at the Ace Hotel for a packed audience, and it was great to see it on a big screen again. And I realized it's a pre-CGI movie. It was made just on the cusp, just before they figured out what they were doing there.
That's right.
So the optical effects are very few in number.
Yep.
There's very little that isn't practical effects in that movie. And it doesn't matter because it's great storytelling and Zemeckis at his best.
At his
best. He and Bob Gale, what a team they were.
Incredible. Yeah. Maybe a perfect screenplay. Yeah. Maybe an absolute perfect screenplay. And then the film, of course, he did after that, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, biggest film of that year. I was also obsessed with that film. Classic film. I feel like people need to revisit that more. I think it's
that's a good recommendation.
Star Wars and Back to the Future is still seems to be in the forefront of consciousness. Yes. And that has not been as much for whatever reason.
You're right.
But that film, and I remember reading Starlog magazine and learning about how these films were made and how Bob Hoskins almost went crazy because he had to act to nothing as he was doing. And it occurred to me a few years ago, that's how every movie is made now.
Yeah.
Every one of our movies is made like that nowadays. And what a pioneering film that was.
Yes. Yeah.
I don't know that that's been, I don't know
if people
revisited that.
A lot of envelopes.
Absolutely.
All at once. Once again, thank you, Kevin.
Thank you.
Continued success to you. What's next out of the hatch? What's coming immediately?
I think we'll be down at 466 with Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2.
Volume 2.
Now, I know what you're thinking. What did I get for my 1 year anniversary from my husband, right? What did I get?
I was wondering that, actually.
I know you were thinking about it. I got a Groot that when you press the button, he dances to Jackson 5.
Nice.
That is what came in the mail.
Nice.
And I play it, and I was trying to show my parents. It's like, look what Scott gave me.
Yes.
It's a dancing Groot.
Yes, there's
because
more dancing
good
to be
husband.
Had.
Oh, God, I can't with baby Groot.
There's baby more Groot.
We've seen the trailer.
I dare not dream.
Oh, no.
What's coming up.
And it's still Vin Diesel.
It certainly is.
When we saw the trailer, I said, please, God, let that be Vin Diesel. Please let that be Vin Diesel that they've now made sound like a baby. And then it is. And see, I'm becoming one of you.
It's great. It's great.
I'm one of you now.
Better not to resist.
That's right. There is no resistance.
There is no resistance. Is no nope.
Resistance. Well, thank you. Now, do you social media? Do you participate? Or
I have a Twitter account, but it is few and far between.
Okay.
As I use it.
Because you would only have a few million, you know, to deal with on a daily basis.
No.
But Jesse, you have the ability to be reached. Yes?
I does at Jesse Malton, and you're at Leonard Malton.
Amazingly so.
Funny,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes, yes. And then there's that website of mine, leonardmalton.com. Please come and visit and read whatever I've had to say that was worth reading, I hope. We are so pleased to have Kevin here today. We will see you again next week with another wonderful guest to be named.
To be
at a later
TBD.
Time. Thanks for listening, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.